Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to present a recording of Christine McLaughlin's talk, Producing History in an Auto Town, Oshawa After World War II. It is part of the 2011 History Matters Lecture Series, sponsored by the Toronto Public Library and the History Education Network. You can find recordings of other talks from the 2011 History Matters Lecture Series at ActiveHistory.ca.
Explore the process of public history creation in post-war Oshawa. I'm going to suggest that this has been a highly political process. Public memory in Oshawa has been significantly shaped by the forces of power, money, and privilege, while challenges to the status quo have been largely eliminated from the city's streetscapes. However, these moments of challenge and resistance offer an important legacy for future generations and ought to be preserved. Oshawa, Ontario, like so many industrial casualties in our so-called era of post-industrialism, is undergoing a fundamental break with its past. Home to the corporate headquarters of General Motors of Canada and the site of one of the largest production facilities in North America, the city's manufacturing base has eroded in the wake of a long and slow process of deindustrialization. Plant closures and layoffs have rocked the city, upsetting thousands of lives in the process. Manufacturing is history, we are told, at least in the industrialized countries where unionized workers have won considerable gains and benefits. Critics of deindustrialization have uncovered many problems with this term. Industrial production has not stopped. More often, it has shifted within a global economy to areas with lower labor or environmental regulations, with maximization of profits as a driving force. If we accept the premise that wealth is generated by a society, then the way that wealth is distributed within that society, or who will enjoy the fruits of that labor, becomes highly contestable terrain. In cities and towns across North America in the 1930s and onwards, many working people actively contested this terrain, seeking a more equitable and democratic distribution of this wealth and power. One of the main vehicles industrial workers used was the newly forming industrial unions. Unions were certainly not new, but prior to this, most workers were organized by skilled trade. Industrialism and the slow shift to factory production created a large market for unskilled work. As the ranks of unskilled workers grew, the idea of organizing both skilled and unskilled workers by workplace rather than by trade grew in popularity. Miners were first to put industrial unionism into practice, but many of the earliest major victories for industrial unionism emerged from the automobile industry. My specific focus here is on the automobile industry, and more specifically Oshawa, but it's important to bear in mind that developments in Oshawa were part of a much larger network, holding local, provincial, national, and even international implications. When auto workers in Oshawa struck in 1937, winning one of the first victories for industrial unionism in Canada, they were very much a part of a larger movement. Public history production in Oshawa, like many other cities and towns, is highly localized in scope, celebrating local heroes and notables. But by what process do these people come to be commemorated? What forces have shaped public history production? How does this in turn shape our collective memory? Tributes to its captains of industry dominate public space and preoccupy local history production. One name in particular continues to claim public space in Oshawa, situated as a primary foundation of the city's creation myth. The late Colonel Robert Samuel McLaughlin, a founder and former president of General Motors of Canada, is frequently extolled as the father of Oshawa. His presence continues to linger over the city long after his bodily remains have been laid to rest. Colonel Sam is often remembered as a benevolent philanthropist, a man to whom we all owe a great debt of gratitude, a man who single-handedly, it often seems, built the city of Oshawa. Within this project of memory creation, the actual historical record has often been subverted, which in the process has arguably served particular ideological viewpoints. The myth of Colonel Sam was very much a post-war production, located in the broader context of a reassertion of capitalist authority in the post-World War II period. The symbols of this myth inscribe the principles of individualism, property, and private charity in the wake of broad-based support for unionism and collective action that characterized much of the mid-20th century. This public script of benevolence, goodwill, and class harmony was created at the same time that managerial authority and corporate power were being very strongly reasserted within and outside of the city's production plants. From the shop floors to the city streets, many acts of resistance challenged this unchecked capitalist control. However, these acts of resistance remain largely hidden from our current public memory, confined to the individual recollections of those who directly participated in these events. These moments of resistance and collective action are an incredibly important part of our history. They remind us of what can be achieved when people act together to improve our collective lived circumstances. In our current era of escalating corporate power amidst eroding working and living conditions, this message continues to be a critical one. R.S. McLaughlin is widely commemorated in Oshawa as its founding father, a generous philanthropist who cared above all about the welfare of workers in his community. The historical record is somewhat more complicated. Colonel Sam was the son of Robert McLaughlin, founder of the McLaughlin Carriage Company. By the turn of the 20th century, this company was, well, it claimed to be the largest in the empire. The McLaughlins negotiated a deal with Billy Durant of General Motors, and the McLaughlin Motor Company was founded in 1907. In 1918, Sam McLaughlin sold the Canadian production facility to General Motors, remaining a major shareholder, president of General Motors of Canada, and chairman of the board, and he also sat on the board of directors for the parent company, General Motors. As Heather Robertson has explored in much more detail in a great book called Driving Force, the efforts of others in bringing about these changes were largely written out of the narrative that Sam constructed in the wake of these events. He placed himself front and center as the driving force in bringing the automobile industry to Oshawa. Sam McLaughlin epitomized conspicuous consumption. The list of properties he accumulated is literally overwhelming. In 1915, amidst the carnage of World War I, he purchased Oshawa's only amusement park so that he could construct his private estate on the 14-acre site. It was the most expensive house to have ever been built in Canada at the time and included a private bowling alley, indoor swimming pool, stables, and accommodation for 40 servants. 3 years later, General Motors donated lakefront property to be used as a city park. A plaque was erected ensuring that this act of corporate benevolence would long inform public memory in the city. Sam McLaughlin also maintained a 470-acre farm, which housed an indoor arena, half-mile track, and stables for 65 horses and a herd of purebred Jersey cattle. When the Depression hit, he spent more on his horses and personal leisure pursuits than on relief for the city's unemployed. He was hailed in the local press, however, when in the face of mass unemployment in the city, he opted to add another wing to his private estate, thus creating a make-work project. It was not until the late 1940s, and especially into the 1950s, that Colonel Sam developed a much more vigorous spirit for giving. Although there were undoubtedly many factors that led to this change, a couple are particularly noteworthy. One was changes to tax laws, which made charitable donations, gave a tax credit for charitable donations, and so made it a bit more of a profitable endeavor. The second, and perhaps most compelling, involves changes that were taking place on the ground in Oshawa. In 1937, GM workers in the city went on strike, forming Local 222 of the United Auto Workers. Key to this victory was the wide-based community support that strikers received. Over the next few years, a unionization wave swept the city as workers in most of the city's major workplaces organized, along with hotel workers, city workers, working-class housewives, to name just a few examples. Labor representatives began being elected to city council, and by the mid-1940s, CCF candidates were being elected to represent the riding. Prior to the Great Depression, General Motors had developed a complex welfare system as a means of quelling labor strife. Following the lead of many other large producers at the time, it offered a very intricate welfare program through its industrial relations department in Detroit to propagate the family spirit of General Motors. It positioned itself as a practical utopia, answering Sir Thomas More's dream of a state furnishing common tables with group insurance, serving 99% of the plant's 4,500 permanent employees. The welfare scheme also included an employee savings and investment fund, so that employee savings were invested for him in company shares, and provisions were made for transferring savings funds to home-owning purposes. The company paid its Oshawa workers neither by cash nor check, but by weekly deposit slips, showing that certain amounts had been placed to their credit in the corporation's bank, or from time to time they'd allow the workers to choose a banking institution themselves. The company also funded sports teams, built a convention hall, sponsored orchestras and choirs, picnics, group games, contests, dances, social gatherings, literary and dramatic societies, and offered correspondence courses for education. Along with paying the highest wages in the city, and thus cementing its status as the most benevolent employer in the area, the company was able to stifle discontent temporarily. However, this welfare scheme collapsed during the Depression. By the 1940s, unionism had become a significant part of working class culture in Oshawa. In light of these political changes on the ground, Sam McLaughlin may have felt a need to redeem his public image as he embarked on a spirited campaign of giving in the post-war period. Gift-giving had long been realized as a politically advantageous act, a useful means of maintaining a paternalist order in cities, towns, and workplaces. Often the only thing the poor have to give in return is their thanks, praise, and loyalty. Gift-giving as a one-way process can create a deep sense of indebtedness among the recipients of these gifts. One thing is certain, Sam McLaughlin was clearly preoccupied with claiming these gifts as his own by physically attaching his name to each and every single one. This insistence on etching his name on a public script of Oshawa's past is revealing, and has in some cases served broader ideological purposes, very much shaping how residents view and remember the history of their city. Many of the gifts the McLaughlins gave the city had deep roots in middle-class agencies of moral regulation of the working class, at least at that time. In 1946, they donated a vacant house that they had built for one of their daughters to be used as a YWCA. And the behavior of single young women was monitored here, and classes were held to teach immigrant women so-called Canadian ways. It was named Adelaide House in honor of Colonel Sam's wife. In 1947, Sam purchased a public park in Oshawa and presented it as the private property of the Boy Scouts movement. Named Camp Sam Mack for Sam McLaughlin, it contained an Olympic swimming pool, log cabins, and a council hall. It also featured a 16-foot pole dedicated to the Cubs, a 26-foot pole dedicated to the Scouts, and a 40-foot totem pole known as the Big Chief, with carvings depicting the life and times of Sam McLaughlin. And so a house was donated to the Girl Guides a year later, I guess, as an afterthought. In 1950, citizens in Oshawa had the opportunity to vote on the construction of some new civic institutions. Well, a new city hall was endorsed by a popular vote. A majority expressed satisfaction with their current library, rejecting the construction of a new one. Soon after, Sam McLaughlin announced that he would be footing the bill to pay for a new library in the city, which would be named the McLaughlin Public Library. The original library, located in the heart of downtown Oshawa, was used for union and welfare work before it was demolished in 1956. This reflects one of the major problems with private acts of charity, for while they are, in a small sense, publicly subsidized through tax credits, the decision-making process is a highly undemocratic one. It's one person who decides what to give and where it will go. In 1951, he established the McLaughlin Foundation to maintain and expand his private charitable work. Having largely covered much of Oshawa, he began reaching beyond its borders. He was an avid supporter of post-secondary education, although notably not usually in Oshawa, and donated McLaughlin Hall and McLaughlin College to Queen's and York Universities, respectively, along with establishing the now-defunct McLaughlin Planetarium in Toronto. And so I could go on and on and on. But Sam McLaughlin's charitable contributions have already been incredibly well documented, assuming a primary position in local history production in Oshawa. We may ask how great an effect these acts of gift-giving, public performance, and naming really have. Are these determining forces in shaping collective memory? Oral histories have become an increasingly popular method in historical research. They provide a really useful way to delve into some of these questions. Of course, oral sources do not offer a perfect, unfiltered view of the past, although neither does any source. People can embellish events, while memory is a highly fluid and organic process which can change over time. For example, those who lived in the free world through the Cold War era may have been highly influenced by a pervasive discourse that really place the world into two camps, democracy versus communism, good versus evil. This can really play a big role in the way that they remember their own radical left politics before the Cold War, at a time when radical left politics were much more acceptable. And so, in effect, memory can change over time in a way that written sources don't. But written sources also present many challenges. What we read and the meaning we take from it is very much shaped by our own cultural context. In addition, what is preserved for history is infused with power dynamics. Often, surviving written records have been produced by a cultural elite. These written sources, some philosophers argue, tell us more about the people writing the documents than the people, places, or events that they may have been trying to describe. This offers particularly different challenges for social historians who attempt to record the history of everyday people, many of whom, for one reason or another, did not leave behind any written documentation of their lives. And finally, written sources are also infused with the spoken word. Court records, meeting minutes, newspaper articles, many of these are attempts to capture oral accounts on paper. The official history of Sam McLaughlin, as just one example, which is repeated again and again and again in local written sources in Oshawa, was originally based on oral interviews with Sam McLaughlin. And in these interviews, he provided his own interpretation of his role in bringing the automobile industry to the city. So oral histories of working people in Oshawa offer a bit of a counter-narrative to the official history of the city as it can be read through its monuments, memorials, and newspapers. This highlights that collective memory can be shaped through a complex array of forces. Writing on public memory in the United States, John Bodner distinguishes between what he calls official and vernacular memory. He describes official memory as efforts by the state to mythologize itself and maintain the loyalty of its citizens, while vernacular memory reflects the needs of ordinary people to pursue their social and political concerns in their local communities. A diverse body of stories emerge from oral histories. However, some common elements do punctuate these personal histories across multiple interviews. In Oshawa, many people emphasize events which place working people at the front and center of historical change. In these stories, the gains of working people were not simply handed to them by kind, wealthy benefactors. Rather, improvements in living and working conditions were the result of direct action, a willingness to stand up and fight for them. The reoccurrence of certain events across many historical narratives suggests that these are an important component of collective memory in Oshawa as well, despite the fact that they may not be commemorated in the city's official public historical script. Often these counter-narratives coexist alongside the city's official public history. And so some people will repeat the official narrative that has been so frequently reproduced in local media outlets and other forms of history productions. Many point to each of the symbols of philanthropy that dot Oshawa's memoryscape as evidence of the importance of Sam McLaughlin to the community of Oshawa. A smaller number will take a much more critical view. Some point out that Colonel Sam's millions were the reward of other people's labor, and that his power to give was a highly undemocratic process rooted in the labor that they gave to General Motors. At the same time, resistance is also a key theme that emerges in interviews. This can encompass an incredibly wide range of diverse issues. From individual to collective acts of resistance, people frequently privilege stories of challenge to authority in many different spaces, from workplaces to city streets, to homes, to the corridors of government and the law. At times, very similar stories cross many different interviews, indicating events that have also shaped collective memory in the city. These events have been repeated again and again, passed from one generation to the other, so that even those who did not experience the events directly will still transmit this history. Experience also plays a key role in these narratives, indicating important generational differences at the same time. And so people who lived through the 1937 strike at General Motors position this much more vividly and centrally within their life histories. It's a really defining moment. Remembering well what it was like to work at GM before they unionized, they countered this with the many ways that unionism directly improved their lives. These stories have continued to be passed down to younger generations, but this event does not always as vividly inform the narratives of people who did not directly experience it. And so Oshawa was the scene of many, many strikes, rallies, and protests in the post-war period. And it was widely referred to as a union town. General Motors was the single largest employer in the city. During the 20th century, many of the manufacturing sites in the area shifted to auto parts production, serving as feeder plants for the corporate behemoth. Automobile production increased exponentially in the 1950s, sparking major growth in the epicenter of GM's Canadian operations. Between 1949 and 1951, the city's population grew from just over 28,000 to more than 41,000 people, and increased to 60,000 by the 1960s. Employment at GM grew by similar leaps and bounds. From approximately 4,000 to 5,000 workers through the 1940s, by the mid-1950s, there were 14,000 people on GM's payroll, and 10,000 of these were unionized workers. Many of the workers from the auto parts factories were also organized in UAW Local 222, so that the local itself had anywhere between 15,000 and 18,000 members, making it the single largest union local in North America. The Oshawa District Labor Council, which is an umbrella organization that brought together unionized workers in the area, grew from a membership of 5,000 when it was founded in 1942 to approximately 27,000 members by the 1960s. Given the sheer dominance of auto work to the local economy, when GM shut down, everyone felt the ripple effects. This might explain why one of the most recurring themes in people's recollections of Oshawa's past is the 1955 strike at GM. Lasting 148 days, nearly 6 long months, many position it as a major turning point in their lives. The strike involved 17,000 GM workers in Toronto, St. Catharines, London, Windsor, and Oshawa. Earlier efforts to coordinate national bargaining had been very rocky. The UAW negotiated a 5-year contract in 1950, but many workers were left unhappy with the settlement and forced the contract to be reopened in 1953. Local 222 was the only group to reject the ensuing deal and refuse the negotiated pay increase. When coordinated bargaining was tried again in 1955, a separate bargaining team had to be established for Local 222 to address the concerns specific to the massive General Motors complex in Oshawa, where well over half of GM's Canadian workforce was employed. Workers were seeking an improved seniority system, a company-funded healthcare and welfare plan, greater job security, a union shop, and an apprenticeship program. Another key demand was the guaranteed annual wage. Layoffs were basically an annual event at GM. They would shut down once a year to change over to new model production. And so workers were basically asking for a supplement to their employment insurance during these shutdowns so that they would have a steadier annual income. A deal was reached on February 14th, 1956. Workers won the guaranteed annual wage, stronger pensions, the union shop, the apprenticeship program, and COLA, which accounted for cost of living increases between contracts. Seniority issues in Oshawa were addressed, and the incentive pay system, which based pay on how fast a worker could produce, was eliminated. This had been a very contentious issue in Oshawa. People argued it was really unfair to older workers. GM agreed to pay half of a health plan. However, given that Premier Frost and Prime Minister St. Laurent had begun talks on a Canadian health plan, it was speculated that workers were more willing to concede on this issue. The 1955 strike is overwhelmingly remembered as a victory for working people. However, it isn't the facts, figures, and details that most people recount. Positioned as a major turning point in their life histories, people who lived through the strike speak of the difficulties that factory workers and their families faced in making ends meet before 1955, and the deep relief that greater financial stability brought in the years after. Many families clearly faced great hardship while forgoing wages for a full 6 months, and some nearly lost their homes. However, these stories of hardship tend to be minor punctuations in a much larger story of how people came together, helping each other to overcome these difficulties. The old library was used as a gathering place where striking workers organized assistance for each other. Some women emphasized their efforts in collecting home heating materials and other essentials from local business owners, whom they credit with being a critical source of support during this time. Other women talk about putting their sewing skills to work at the old library, making and repairing children's clothes, and making winter coats. During the holiday season, the library was converted to a toy shop where volunteers made toys to ensure that children would still get a gift. And children, it would seem, were largely sheltered from the sacrifices required for a 6-month-long strike. Yet the strike is still raised as an important moment in the city's history, even by those who were young or not even born yet. This suggests that the strike has become a key event in local collective memory, as stories have been passed from one generation to another. Another strike that has become almost mythic in Oshawa is the 1966 strike of workers at the Oshawa Times. By that point, the city's only newspaper. In many respects, the strike couldn't be more radically different from the 55 strike at GM. It involved 34 members of the Oshawa unit of the Toronto Newspaper Guild, and it lasted 2 weeks. The main issues in the strike surrounded pay, job security, union security, and automation in the workplace. However, when the employer won an injunction limiting pickets to 10 people, the strike at the Oshawa Times immediately became a highly contested site. Injunctions had become a more common management tool to limit the power of striking workers, and judges were showing an increasing willingness to award them. According to accounts of the time, the Oshawa District Labor Council was the first in the country to officially challenge the use of injunctions. When the local sheriff arrived to present the injunction to striking workers, he was greeted by a crowd of over 200 people. He was unable to finish reading it aloud, and he was jeered, pelted with snowballs, and a woman in the crowd tried to rip the injunction from his hands, tearing off the cover and throwing it in the snow. Each day thereafter, nearly 200 people swelled the picket lines at the Times, even though the legal limit had been set at 10. Local police were unable to enforce the injunction. Other workers of the Times refused to cross the picket lines, even though their collective agreements required them to do so, effectively shutting the newspaper down for the duration of the strike. These events garnered wide media coverage, launching a public debate over the use of injunctions in workplace disputes. It also became a foundational moment in a wider challenge that sprang up against limits on workers' rights to strike. Granted, not everybody directly participated in this event. Rather, a militant minority, so to speak, led the charge. Did they carry the support of what we might call a silent majority? We may never know. In the following elections, however, the majority of voters in Oshawa supported strong advocates of workers' rights at the polls amid a much larger global context of protest, resistance, and revolt. Provincially, Oshawa had long been a CCF and later NDP stronghold. Progressive Conservative candidate Albert Walker had won the riding in 1963, but was defeated after his first term by NDP candidate Cliff Pilkey in 1967. Cliff Pilkey was the president of the Oshawa District Labor Council, and he played a leading and very public role in challenging the use of injunctions. On the federal scene, in 1968, a young political science professor at York University by the name of Ed Broadbent defeated longtime Conservative MP Michael Starr, who, incidentally, was the first Ukrainian-Canadian elected to Parliament. And so Broadbent won that by 15 votes. Of course, there are many, many, many other events beyond strikes that inform public memory. Important sites of memory are another recurring theme when people share their life histories. One such cultural institution in the city is the Oshawa Civic Auditorium. When its arena burned to the ground in 1953, the city lost its beloved hockey team, the Oshawa Generals. The Civic was built to replace it and bring the Gens back to Oshawa. I've often been proudly told by many a worker that workers built the Civic, and they paid through it through regular payroll deductions. More recently, the Civic has been replaced by the newly constructed General Motors Center. A rather unfortunate name choice, perhaps, given it was financed with public dollars. Another important theme that arises in oral histories is generational change and the ways in which understandings of the past can erode with the passage of time. I frequently heard that younger generations take many of the gains that were won by working people for granted. That they lack an appreciation of how hard people fought for these. There are also lots of concerns expressed over the future of our young people, and, you know, fears that they're going to have to fight these exact same battles themselves. Many of the gains made in collective bargaining eventually passed into labor law. Indeed, organized labor could be a potent lobbying force in seeking to expand workers' rights more generally. Overtime pay, minimum wage laws, paid vacations, pensions, workers' compensation, health and safety legislation, public health care, affordable housing, maternity leave. Many of these were hard-won gains of the 20th century that organized labor has championed. But what has been done can also be undone. Improvements to living and working standards that have been won can also be lost. History has been no linear march on a one-way path towards progress. Instead, it has been marked by ebbs and flows, victories and losses. Sometimes one step forward has quickly been followed by two steps back. The Oshawa and District Labor Council has, in some important instances, been on the leading edge of progressive thought and action. Sam McLaughlin, so widely commemorated in Oshawa, expressed deep regret over having to sell the company to GM in 1918, but clearly he had no other choice. With five daughters and no sons, there was no one in the family capable of running the operations. And I think it would be 1992 before GM had its first woman president. In 1948, the Oshawa and District Labor Council was the first in the country to elect a woman as its president, Mabel Main. In 1960, it endorsed and supported Oshawa's first female mayor, Christine Thomas, and helped to elect another one of their endorsed women candidates in the same election. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, unions were not always fair and equal spaces for women. To suggest otherwise would be to minimize the many battles women fought for equality within their unions and their workplaces. Unions could, however, offer a useful vehicle for mounting challenges against discrimination. General Motors of Canada, like many other companies, has a long history of discriminatory hiring practices. Having at various points refused to hire people on the basis of religion, ethnicity, race, physical appearance, and sex. The UAW was a lot slower to challenge sex-based discrimination, and for much of the 20th century, women remained a minority in the workplace, confined to sex-segregated departments, separate seniority lists, and lower pay scales. By 1962, the Ontario Human Rights Code barred discrimination on the basis of color, race, creed, and national origin, but did not include sex. In 1969, members of the UAW Local 222 Women's Committee approached their MPP, Cliff Pilkey, convincing him to present a private member's bill. Bill 83, an act to prevent discrimination in employment because of sex or marital status, was presented to the legislature soon after. Following a lengthy year and a half wait, it passed into law in December of 1970. Sexual discrimination has since been illegal in Ontario workplaces. And yet, where are the public sites of commemoration in Oshawa to this and other important moments for working people in the city's long and storied history? Sadly, they are very few and far between, largely non-existent. Each passing generation becomes further removed from this vibrant history. A powerful rhetoric has gained increasing legitimacy in recent decades. As corporations have relocated production facilities to areas with weak labor and environmental standards, far too many have joined in pointing the finger at so-called greedy unions that somehow forced this corporate exile. Meanwhile, corporate leaders who have made the choice to maximize profits by paying the cheapest possible labor costs have somehow emerged on the right side of history. When did the ruling classes convince us that their interests were somehow our interests? I've discussed a very small piece of this much larger puzzle today, but I think some important lessons from this past can be drawn for our present and our future. Private philanthropy, along with the privatization and corporate naming of public space, has continued largely unchecked in our very own modern times. This can carry deep political implications, often reflecting wealth, power, and privilege rather than a fair and balanced view of the historical record. Our past can and should better equip us to make more informed decisions about our present and future circumstances. Sites of commemoration can have a powerful effect on shaping public memory, making these highly political spaces. Additionally, we can learn a lot from our elders if we're willing to sit down and listen. Their stories can offer important counter-narratives to official public histories, sometimes offering alternate views of the past. These histories are often equally, if not more, legitimate than the official histories being produced. A rich collection of stories continues to inform collective memory as these are passed orally from generation to generation, but they do also fade with the passage of time. These stories ought to be preserved so that we can continue to benefit from the lessons they offer. Sam McLaughlin's name continues to loom large over the city of Oshawa, but the stories of working people offer important alternate versions of history. Space in our cities ought to be made for commemorating and remembering these stories. If we truly want our history to be a reflection of the principles of a modern democracy, then more democratic history making is a good place to begin.
You've been listening to a recording of Christine McLaughlin's talk, Producing History in an Auto Town, Oshawa After World War II. It is part of the 2011 History Matters lecture series, sponsored by the Toronto Public Library and the History Education Network. You can find recordings of other talks from the 2011 History Matters lecture series at activehistory.ca.